The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Happy Thanksgiving. Let us break bread together on our knees. We gather together to share. The day has come. Thanksgiving, the holiday with the best intentions of all the holidays, I think, unless you're a turkey. Classic feast, the long table, filled elbow to elbow with friends, relatives, solo folks, maybe some pets and unexpected animal friends under the table, waiting for scraps and spills. It's quite a large territory, if you think about it, the Thanksgiving table. Way up there at the head, the adults, who might say the prayers and thank everyone for coming. Very formal up here.
It's been quite a year.
And we're not even in December yet.
Well, don't say that. It's bad luck.
Oh, come on. I didn't mean anything by it. But what's going on with your brother and Margaret? Something seems off.
Stop that. It's Thanksgiving.
Oh, right. It's Thanksgiving.
And over here, the center of the table, where the loud older siblings are talking or maybe bragging.
Well, I said to my agent, not a penny under six figures. And he said, six figures? We're going for lucky seven.
Well, the organic farm we started in Mozambique is actually harvesting its first gluten-free peppers. And we have eliminated poverty in this village. We're building a school now. It's just amazing.
You know, at Thanksgiving, you really have to decide who and what you want to listen to with this many conversations going on, unless you're sitting close to the kids' table.
Justin Bieber said he's sorry. Really?
No, stupid. That's the name of a song.
Same thing. So do you think Kanye would make a better president than Trump?
Yeah, and Ben Carson should become Surgeon General.
Hey, Dad said we could have champagne later.
Awesome!
And sometimes there's a slightly unusual seating at the table, where it can feel a little drafty and awkward. Here's Uncle Tim, his girlfriend Jihan, and Grandma trying to break the ice.
Jihan, that's an Arab name, right?
It's an African name.
So you Muslims don't have Thanksgiving pilgrims like at Plymouth Rock, right?
Grandma, for heaven's sake!
Actually, Muslims have millions of pilgrims. They just go to a different rock.
You see, Timothy, Muslims do celebrate Thanksgiving.
You know, just like having to be concerned with choosing what you're going to eat on Thanksgiving Day, you have to choose what conversation to focus on. You can't listen to everything. It's a feast for the ears, and all this hour, tips for how to listen, what to listen for, and advice on getting past some of those unexpected, or I guess, not so unexpected silences. And to help us get through those, we found Joshua Johnson, the host of KQED's So Well Spoken, a show featuring candid conversations about race and identity. He joined us from San Francisco just after hosting his own Thanksgiving special. Johnson says thorny issues might be best left for another time, but if they come up at the family table, they are opportunities for communication.
Most of the encounters that we have dealt with are people who think they're just being benign. You know, most of the encounters with race that people will deal with are nowhere near the level of dragging someone to HR or filing charges or calling the police or, God forbid, having any kind of a physical confrontation. It's that 99.999% of encounters that just happen. They happen very quickly, subtly. They almost happen without notice. And then the offended party goes, wait, what? Say that again? And then it escalates.
Well, in your encounters with listeners out at KQED in San Francisco and from all over the country who pay attention to your show, what kinds of stories are you getting?
In the show we did about the holidays, we had a story from a woman who's Chinese American, married into a Mexican American family. They brought last Christmas her mother-in-law a new digital camera, which she wanted. And with the digital camera, they included an ultrasound picture of their new baby because they were expecting.
Let's hear the story. We've got it right here. Let's just cue that story right now.
Everyone started coming over to give me hugs, and everyone was sobbing. And when it got to his sister-in-law, she kind of looked real hard at the ultrasound, and she said, well, it looks like the baby's going to be part Chinese. And then everyone kind of, like, laughed, or, I mean, I uncomfortably laughed, and so did my husband. I don't even know if my husband laughed. He might have just been completely silent. And I just remember, oh, my God, I'm just so sick to my stomach right now. I can't believe she said that. And then I was, I didn't know if it bothered my husband or not, but I asked him later and he said, absolutely, it made me 100% uncomfortable. And he said his reaction was he wanted to say to everyone, you know, my wife comes down here for Christmas every year to spend Christmas with us. And why do you have to make her feel like an outsider? And I said, yeah, that's how I feel. And I felt better that he said that because I felt like an outsider at that moment.
Wow. That's a really emotional story. And, you know, stories like that get recycled year after year after year, including the resolution, whether you talked about it or not, right?
Yeah, it seems like there might be some resolution. The sister-in-law, we contacted her and asked her about it. The sister-in-law talked to us. She said she doesn't remember saying that, but she trusts Amy's version of events. She says that may well have happened, says she didn't mean any harm by it, and that she's open to talking about it, to trying to make peace.
Now, if you're listening, and that's really important, you're listening for the intent of the speaker. And in many ways, the way you resolve these kinds of uncomfortable situations is to figure out, you know, where they were coming from and to see if that was a forgivable place or if they were doing something that was either completely intolerant or really hurtful. How do you sort that out?
Well, the way we've sorted it out is just to ask them, to go back to them and say, you know, put yourself back where you were. What happened? What led up to that? What did you mean by that? You know, do you think you know where you were coming from at that moment? Through having done a few of these shows, we found that a number of people who have it put to them realize afterward, oh, okay, you see this in a way that I didn't see it. And in the heat of the moment, nobody's really thinking through that kind of thing until you give them a chance to step back and unpack it.
Alcohol can be kind of a truth serum here, right?
That almost makes it sound beneficial and useful. It's more like a truth potion, really.
But listen and see if there's any recovery from this kind of a story.
James Flint from Rochester, New York. So I was about 15 years old, and I took my girlfriend at the time to Thanksgiving. My grandma, she had been drinking a lot of wine that day, and she looks at me and my girlfriend, and she just goes, if the Indians come, act crazy. That way they won't scalp you and they'll think the spirits got to you. It was super embarrassing. I had to look at my girlfriend and tell her, we're not all like this. I don't know what she's talking about, getting scalped from Indians. I don't know. And the rest of the dinner proceeded from there.
So any advice on how the rest of the dinner could proceed from there after something like that?
We've dealt with a few situations that are alcohol-fueled. Granted, I don't consider alcohol an excuse for bad behavior. Often it is just the catalyst for bad behavior. But that also requires people to deal with whether or not you want to prosecute based on what you heard from this truth potion, whether or not somebody just popped off at the mouth and said something that does not reflect their better judgment, or whether you were finally hearing the real them.
Well, here's an example of something, classic Midwest moment, right, where you try to use the toast to avoid the argument, and you think you're going to survive. You think you've got a brilliant idea here, and it didn't quite work out. I was at a family gathering with aunts, uncles, and cousins. There's a wide range of viewpoints in my family, but one uncle leans very conservative. He made a disparaging remark about Black Lives Matter, and I ignored it. Then he made a disparaging comment about Somali immigrants, and I ignored it. Finally, he made a comment about people leeching off the government by applying for Obamacare. I'd had it at that point. I gave a toast, a big speech about wanting to live in a world where we all have access to health care, where immigrants are welcome, and where Black people don't live in fear. Everyone fell silent. I don't think I changed any minds. I just came across as a loudmouth, which suggests, again, this is a very high-risk venue for these kinds of discussions.
Very, very high risk. My grandmother liked to use the expression, you bend a sapling while it's young. Once you try to bend it, once it's grown, you're just going to get a broken foot. I bet if the listener had started on the first comment and said, you know what, we're not going to have that. We're moving on from that. We're not talking about that. Let's go around the table, hear what everyone is thankful for. That could have shut it down. But if you let it go and let it go and let it go and let it go and let it go, the sapling ain't a sapling anymore.
A lot of writers on race, and I'm speaking particularly of Ta-Nehisi Coates, suggests that the way to deal with this is with blunt candor, just cut to the chase.
Yeah. If I say something stupid, I would rather you get upset with me and give me a chance to fix it. If I don't know how you feel, if I don't know that I just said something that was prejudiced or that was sexist or homophobic or Islamophobic or that was narrow-minded toward the disabled or veterans or people of a particular political persuasion, I can't fix it. That's why these things fester. All the stories we've done on our project, we have never had one where someone had a chance to explain themselves and we thought, we didn't need that explanation. That was a total waste of time. We should have just gone on to the next story. It has never failed. It's never a bad decision to give someone a chance to try and make it right. Whether they do or not is a whole nother matter. But everyone deserves a chance to try and make it right. And of all the people that we've had on our program, not one of them has ever expressed regret for giving someone a chance to find forgiveness.
Don't wait till the pumpkin pie to say you're sorry.
No, you might wait. You might say it before you sit down at the table because there are sharp objects at the table, which makes everything worse.
Now you're scaring me. You're scaring
you ought to be scared. See, that's why you apologize before you get to the table. I'm saving lives, John.
Maybe that's the prayer. That's the prayer. I pray that I don't say anything stupid to offend everyone here at this table during this Thanksgiving feast.
And bless this meal, amen.
Joshua Johnson, thank you so much. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Same to you, John. Thank you.
Joshua Johnson is the host of KQED's So Well Spoken, a show featuring candid conversations about race and identity. Coming up, our listening tour of the Thanksgiving table continues with a storyteller who turned a misunderstanding into a half-century Thanksgiving tradition, Arlo Guthrie. And what about your Thanksgiving table? What does it sound like and look like?
My name is Luis Rodriguez from Charlotte, North Carolina. As far as Thanksgiving, basic things stay the same. Still the turkey, mashed potatoes, pecan pie. The faces are what's changing. A lot of new faces, husbands, wives, kids coming up. It's really nice.
This is Deanna Graves from Natchez, Mississippi. We're all kind of unsettled this year, so we're going to all meet at Cracker Barrel for Thanksgiving. My son, his ex-wife, and the grandkids.
Hi, this is Pat from Medina, Ohio. Our Thanksgiving table, it used to be set with fancy china and silverware at my parents' house. Now our kids are grown and they have families of their own, and we're just as likely to eat in the kitchen on everyday tableware with whoever's available, but we're still glad to be together.
This is Vince Hubert from Dallas. After 50-plus years of turkey and stuffing, I declared a new tradition. Last year was a Greek Thanksgiving with slow-cooked leg of lamb and Greek potatoes. This year is a Jamaican Thanksgiving of jerk chicken and fish and vegetable rundown with baked bananas for dessert. So much better than a dry, boring turkey.
Michelle says, my Thanksgiving table changes depending on circumstance. 2 years ago, it was me and a boyfriend, now long gone. Last year, three single ladies sharing a simple turkey dinner, and we were going to do it again this year, but we were all invited to a gathering at a friend's home, so it will be about 25 of us, multicultural, gay, straight, all sober, and grateful, sharing traditional and not-so-traditional Thanksgiving favorite foods and companionship. That sounds nice. Coogan in Massachusetts says, while everything on the table remains the same, what is around the table changes most, the new additions, young and old, and poignant reminders of loved ones no longer with us. Their presence remains through the memories we share. We all have so much to be thankful for. Nothing to add to that, but you have more stories, I'm sure. 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org. This is our listening tour of Thanksgiving. It's important listening, and we're going to show you how to listen better this hour. No, I said slice those leeks, not dice them. The difference is important. Don't ever confuse a teaspoon of salt for a tablespoon. Here's something to listen to now that, for a lot of fans, gives you something new with each listen. 50 years ago, folk singer Arlo Guthrie had a Thanksgiving dinner that turned into a fiasco, that turned into a song, that turned into a film, and a half-century-old radio Thanksgiving tradition you can hear every single year, this Arlo Guthrie song.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
You know what I'm talking about. In 18 minutes and 34 seconds, Alice's Restaurant Massacre tells the story of how, on Thanksgiving Day back in 1965, Guthrie offered to take out the trash, received a citation for littering, and eventually found himself refused by the U.S. Draft Board because his criminal conviction for littering made him ineligible to serve. Kind of convenient back in 65. Around the 40th anniversary of the release of the song, John Schaefer sat down with Arlo Guthrie to talk about his most famous, I don't know, His greatest
artistic conception, his greatest hit, absolutely. Schaefer, of course, the host of WNYC's Soundcheck. Happy 50th to Arlo and to all of us who've experienced this for all the 50 years.
It has been hard to avoid it if you listen to the radio on Thanksgiving at any point in the last half century. It really has become a radio tradition.
I mean, I was a young Schaefer in 65. I didn't really get what was going on. It seemed a little racy, a little druggy, a little, what's going on here, Mom? And she would say, oh, pay no attention to Alice's Restaurant. We thought that at Alice's Restaurant, you could get anything you want, man. Some, you know, secret message.
Mm.
But what's your understanding of the tradition and the story and the song?
The main thing to say right up front is that it is a true story. Mm. And that is the first thing that Arlo Guthrie will talk about when you talk to him about Alice's Restaurant.
The older I get, the more ridiculous it seems. But, yeah, absolutely true. And I didn't have to embellish much at all. I mean, I would say about 95% of it is fairly accurate.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah. So the things he changed were like, you know, the 28 color glossy 8x10 photos.
Oh, right.
The circles,
sure.
And arrows.
Sure.
They were actually black and white, but okay. Color sounded funny.
I can hear him say 8x10 glossy photos.
But the other thing is the later exploits at the Whitehall Street draft board.
Right.
All true. But on three different occasions.
I see.
And conflated here so they would fit into one song. But he actually did show up hungover. He did try to convince the psychiatrist that he was crazy. And then finally admitting to his quote-unquote criminal past, which, as you said, is what got him out of the draft.
But there can't be a real Alice, was there?
There was a real Alice. You know, just as this was a real story, Alice was a real person, and I asked Arlo just exactly who she was.
I was going to high school in Western Mass, and they had a couple of wonderful teachers there. One was a guy named Ray and his wife, Alice. Alice was the school librarian. They were the only semi-adults in the school that was listening to the same kind of music that we were listening to Leadbelly and the Rolling Stones and Dylan and all of those kind of guys.
Yeah, these were the people who he and his friends hung out with, and they would go over to the house, a deconsecrated church where they lived. Alice did have a restaurant, but that was later on, and so the title Alice's Restaurant Massacre is one of the embellishments. It's part of the 5% that is fiction in this story.
Is this a protest song? Because, of course, Woody Guthrie did protest songs.
You know, it's a great question, and it's a question I asked Arlo, and he had a pretty interesting answer.
I don't think so. I think it was more cultural, more social. It didn't say vote for this guy or that guy or do this or do that. What it really did was to sort of juxtapose the insanity that was going on at the time. And frankly, it still works today.
Now, you know, it's such a clever song. And when you hear it, I mean, there's not an or an in there. I mean, he does it absolutely just smooth as silk. Mm-hmm. And in all the performances I've ever heard. But it eventually became a bit of he became a slave to the song, right?
Well, you know, it also was a song that had some very, despite his saying that it's not a political song, as a social song, as society changed, the message of the song maybe got a little bit diluted. And so after a while, Arlo actually stopped playing Alice's Restaurant entirely.
Well, we didn't play it again because really, you know, one of the parts of the songs had to do with the draft. And when the draft ended, there wasn't really much point to singing it.
And you can't make jokes about littering anymore.
Well, right. But the big joke of the piece, of course, is this crazy idea that because you had a littering violation on your record, you were not morally fit to be sent halfway around the world, outfitted with a gun, and sent into a village to kill people, which was the entire point of the song.
Great story. It's Arlo.
Mm-hmm.
Great history. But is there anything in the song that suggests it would have been played as a tradition for a half century?
The fact that it mentions Thanksgiving and that it all starts on Thanksgiving, you know, gave people an excuse to do that. Also, you know, in all seriousness, it is a song that was meant to be a kind of communal experience. You know, you hear him get the audience singing at the end of Alice's Restaurant and they sing along and he says, that was horrible.
You want to stop war and stuff, you got to sing loud. And then he threatens the audience by saying, I've been singing this song for 25 minutes. I could do another 25. I'm not tired or proud.
So he's really good. And what are the celebrations? A lot of stuff happening.
All kinds of stuff. 50th anniversary concert at Carnegie Hall in New York, but he's also touring around the country with it. And a big PBS special to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Alice's Restaurant. The Alice's Restaurant Massacre, to use its full title.
Well, that sounds appropriate for PBS.
Yeah.
No Yanni, right?
I'm sure there'll be some Yanni elsewhere on the schedule, but at least we'll get some Arlo.
John Schaefer, host of WNYC's Soundcheck. Have a happy restaurant.
You too, John.
Now, it all started two Thanksgivings ago. It was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving when my friend and I went up to visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice doesn't live in the restaurant. She lives in the church nearby the restaurant in the bell tower with her husband Ray and Foch is a dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they got a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. And having all that room, seeing as how they took out all the pews, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, we found all the garbage in there, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the city dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on.
It's Thanksgiving, and our theme is listening. And there's a lot of listening that goes into the food that goes on the table and that you have to make. And that really means that you need to listen to what's practical, listen to what your stomach is telling you about eating and cooking. And that's why we have our good friend Dan Pashman, host of WNYC's Sporkful podcast, here to help us with the cooking and then the
eating.
There we go. The two most important things. Let's start with the cooking. There is a lot of stress. There can be a lot of advanced planning. It can sometimes seem like the landing at Normandy. How do you avoid that?
Well, I'd say a couple of things about that, John. The first is take a deep breath and focus on the basics. And one of the things I want to kind of speak out a little bit against, you know, we see it in all forms of media. Everyone wants to get noticed, and so they have to be different from everyone else. And we see it in the world of food also. So every year at Thanksgiving, we get this rash of new recipes, new things. And I think that all that really contributes to the anxiety that a lot of people feel. In fact, we talked about this on the Sporkful with New York Times food editor Sam Sifton.
The food media, of which I am a part, each year comes to Thanksgiving with a new idea. Here's a new way to make the turkey. Here are seven great appetizers to change your Thanksgiving feast. And that creates pressure on those of us who are cooking Thanksgiving because we think, well, I guess I do need something new. I can't make my mom's Brussels sprouts again. But really, when else do you make your mom's Brussels sprouts? They're pretty good.
Thank you, Sam, for giving us that permission. So you're not impressed with my special brined solar fried turkey cooked in lava rocks? No.
I am impressed.
Okay.
But how
don't
do you
go there. Right, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, have you been up? How many nights in a row have you been up working on the lava temperature, John?
I'm going basic. But I am so guilty of having done that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I feel like it's a real problem. You know, it's like, think back to your Thanksgivings as a child. What are some of your favorite memories? I'm sure that they probably relate, some of them relate to the food that was served.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what if your mom had made an entirely different Thanksgiving menu every single year because the internet made her feel like she had to?
We would not invite the internet back to Thanksgiving.
Exactly.
They would not be welcome.
Your childhood would probably have been very troubled.
Yeah.
And, you know, thank goodness that didn't happen to you and you ended up on the good track.
Although I wonder what I'm doing with my kids because we do have a lot of variety. I mean, I actually had a conversation yesterday with my wife where I said maybe we should try a French theme this year just for some emotion. Maybe I should not do that.
Well, look, I'm all for – if you feel like your Thanksgiving menu is boring you and you want something different, great. And if you – and I love it. I love hearing stories from people about how they incorporate their different cultural backgrounds and put their own twists on the Thanksgiving feast, and I think that's wonderful.
I'm not saying you have to do the same thing, but I don't want people to feel pressure
right.
to change and do the hot new thing every year just because it's on the internet.
And there's always danger in cooking something you've never cooked before when right. there are other people depending on it. But I love the piece, and this is what you always talk about, is that when the food tells a story and generates stories around the table and people talking about that, their traditions, something new, discoveries, that's the best part.
Totally. And this is something we featured in the Sporkful Thanksgiving special, which is just – we asked our listeners, how do you know it's Thanksgiving in your house? And we got some really beautiful calls from people all over the country with very diverse backgrounds about, you know, a Puerto Rican guy in Kansas City who stuffs the turkey with mofongo and serves it with plantains. Or we talked to one Sporkful listener who was born in Zambia. Her parents are from India, and they have this whole – rich array of spices they use. When they first came here, they had never cooked a whole turkey. So they started off just making a chicken. They were kind of intimidated. But yeah, I think that that stuff is really wonderful.
So let's get to the eating.
Okay.
Now, you've got it all spread out on the table. Dan Pashman, host of the WNYC's Sporkful podcast, is here. Your stomach is talking to you. Your eyes are talking to you. You've got to listen.
That's right. You've got to
Otherwise,
listen.
Otherwise, you could be really miserable.
That's right. You've got to listen to your stomach. And I think it's important to the people stop and think about two types of scarcity that exist at Thanksgiving. The scarcity of your stomach space.
Right, right.
And the foods before you that are the most scarce. Those are the foods you want to focus on. Don't focus on the nuts that are on the table when you arrive or the salad that you could have any old Tuesday night.
Cheese wheels, stay away.
Right. Yeah. Focus on the foods that are either too time-consuming to make any other time of year or that they're a specialty of a relative that you only see at the holidays. That's what you should be eating.
You should remember that there's always going to be turkey leftovers. So you can bail on the turkey for the first day just to make sure you get all the dishes that everyone made.
That's a great point, John. You got to be thinking ahead. Before you take the first bite at Thanksgiving dinner, you should already be thinking about leftovers. Focus on the stuff that's going to run out at the dinner. That's where you want to spend your stomach space.
Are there particular vegetables that, for instance, butternut squash, lots of butter and sort of sugar on the top. Delicious, but if you take four bites of it, do you have room for anything else?
You know, there are some areas where I'll say, I feel like this is the right way, that's the wrong way. With this kind of thing, it's sort of, you know, I'm not going to tell you what food you should like. You know, if butternut squash is your favorite right. thing on the table and that yep. rocks your world and you look forward to Thanksgiving when your Aunt Patty brings the squash, then eat a giant plate full of squash. Nothing wrong with that. Just think about what you're doing.
But there are no particular foods that you have to worry about, like, shutting you down. It's just stay clear of the hors d'oeuvres and the little snacky stuff and just be strategic about your plate.
That's right. And if you're a host, don't serve hors d'oeuvres. Don't put nuts right. out. Help an yeah. eater out. Let us focus on the things that really matter. And speaking of focusing on things, I know that you're focusing in this show, John, about listening.
Being intentional.
That's right.
That's our whole idea.
If you really want to get the most pleasure out of your Thanksgiving meal, don't talk. Listen to your guests. And also, just focus on your food. And I've spoken to Deepak Chopra about this, about mindfulness when you're eating. And this is his advice, and I want you to think about this when you sit down for Thanksgiving dinner.
Sit down quietly, take a few deep breaths, experience gratitude for the abundance of the universe, and then enjoy the food with full awareness and in silence. Feel your body, feel the sensations that are aroused without forcing anything, and don't treat your body as a garbage can.
That's very nice. But I've heard that while everyone's taking a breath and doing the yoga thing, Deepak is like ripping off all the mashed potatoes. Not good.
Well, and speaking of taking a breath, that's another issue that is crucial when you're eating at Thanksgiving. A recent study that was featured on NPR's blog, The Salt, shows that breathing when you eat can have a huge impact on how much flavor you get from each bite. We all know that aroma is a big part of the eating experience. Mm-hmm. When you're breathing at a nice, even pace, you have this natural mechanism that wafts some of the aroma of the food up from your mouth into your nose through the back of your throat and allows you to smell it. If you eat too quickly and you're kind of gasping for air as you eat, you will suck all that aroma down into your lungs and your nose will not be able to smell it as well. On the other hand, if you breathe too slowly, you will not get the correct type of airflow that brings the aroma up to your nose. So a nice, even pace of breathing will naturally waft the aroma to your nose.
The quiet listening people are having the better experience.
That's right.
They're tasting better flavors and more flavors, more intensity.
That's exactly right.
Wow. Well, that's great. What are you having? What are you doing? Doing anything weird? Doing anything coldly traditional?
It's mostly traditional. You know,
ordering in?
Well, it's funny. The last couple of years, I hosted Thanksgiving for the first time. This year, we're sort of going back in time where we're going to my parents' place and they're cooking. And my mom was like, I want you to feel welcome. And, you know, if you want, you can cook one of the – we're cooking two turkeys. You can cook one of them. I was like, heck no. I'll be on the couch with my feet up. I trust you. I'll be with my cocktail in the living room waiting for the turkey.
But now that you're a big foodie, your mom's intimidated when you come over. That's no, great. I love that.
She taught me everything I know.
That's fantastic. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, you too, buddy.
Dan Pashman, host of WNYC's Sporkful Podcast. Listening is a good idea anytime, but it's a particularly good skill to have on Thanksgiving, where the danger of being misheard or misunderstood goes way up. And one of the great benefits of just listening at your Thanksgiving table is that you know when you're listening and not talking, you aren't letting the world see what's in your mouth while you're eating. This is a good thing. Mary Harris is the host of WNYC's podcast Only Human, and on her program, she's been exploring listening as a practical matter of health to make for a healthier Thanksgiving experience. Hear better? Sound like a good idea?
I think that I went into this project thinking of listening as a passive thing, and I think of it as a much more active activity now.
Such as?
So I talked to Arthur Aaron, who's a relationships expert, mm-hmm. to kind of figure out how listening fits in with how we continue our relationships, how our relationships get stronger. And the interesting thing he said to me is that relationships really don't work without listening, but it has these essential elements. The person you're talking to has to understand that you care for them, that you're validating them, and that doesn't mean that they agree with you or you agree with them. It just means that they have an understanding that you know where they're coming from.
And there are all these different relationships around the table at the Thanksgiving table. So you got the mom relationship, the mom-daughter relationship, the dad-son relationship. And then, of course, there may be somebody at the table who can't hear very well. Any advice there?
Well, I think the thing we learned with hearing was that it's so isolating and people are so secretive about it. So the thing to do if you have a relative who can't hear very well, first of all, acknowledge that. Be very expressive with your gestures, because a lot of people, they don't know it, but they're lip reading, they're reading your hand movements, they're reading your face in a way that they may not even understand that they're doing. So be expressive, but don't leave them out. So often they feel left out, ashamed. Don't do that. Make sure you're engaging with them.
So everybody's hearing well, let's just presume, a normal level of hearing. What's the important skill that we need to not mess up? Because it almost seems like you need like a newsletter before you get to the Thanksgiving feast that's going to help you know that who had this kid who went to this school, who, you know, lost this job, so that you don't have awkward conversations. What's the best way of doing that?
I would say don't be afraid to prep. So often we just go in cold and we go to our rote questions that we have in the back of our head. So you see a kid and you say, hey, how's school going? That kid rolls his eyes and sort of runs away. So don't be afraid to actually think about, who am I going to be talking to? What can I talk to them about that's not just the same old thing? So with that kid, maybe ask about soccer instead, if that's what he's into, or chorus. And think about that for the people you're going to be with. What do I want to know from them? What's going to really get us to engage? So often we go into these conversations and we are just waiting for what we have to say. So really go in an open way and think about what the other person will say, and then you'll find you're having a really generous conversation.
And make sure you retain it. You know, this memory is a big deal here.
Yeah. So we talked to Josh Foer, who's a memory champion. He wrote this book, Moonwalking with Einstein, where he actually became the U.S. memory champion at the end of it, sort of by accident. And we asked him, how do you memorize faces and names? Like, say you're going to a dinner with a lot of people you don't know. How do you approach that? And he gave this really, really great example where he said, what if I was memorizing someone's name and their name was Juanita? How would I remember it?
Just riffing here, one eat. So maybe it's like I'm imagining a big number one eating this woman's head and then like burping.
So the weirder, the better.
Oh, weirdness is essential. And this goes back to the earliest memory treatises. They write about this 2,000 years ago in classical Latin. If you want to make something memorable, you have to make it weird.
So he is talking
about... You don't
want
to be in Josh's head, but you definitely want him around your dinner table.
Exactly. So he's talking about making these images in your head so you remember things better. But the funniest part of my conversation with him was that at the end he said, you know, so often we don't remember something because we just didn't care enough to listen.
That's the deal.
And that's the deal.
That is
I think
the deal.
You have to go in and really pay attention and work at it. And that's the secret.
You've got to find a switch that turns on that says, I'm caring enough about what's being said here that I'm going to retain it.
Exactly.
And that's a hard thing for people to do.
Really hard. Well, especially now, so many of us are on Twitter and Facebook, and that's really all about us just spitting out everything about us into the world. It's not really about receiving. And that's what listening's all about, receiving.
Speaking of receiving, empathy, everyone talks about empathy. Empathy is the new black. but seriously, I mean, the key to the value of listening is that it conveys to a person that you care about what they're saying, which means that you're sympathetic with their experience, which bonds you to them in some way.
Yeah.
And you talked to some empathy champions on the show.
Well, we talked to a bunch of people who had done a lot of empathetic listening. So we talked to Ken Feinberg. You've talked to him on the show.
Yeah,
I know.
Sure.
He was the
Great
head
guy.
Of the 9/11 Victim Compensation Fund. He meets with the families of all these terrible tragedies and just listens to their stories. And what he said and what a lot of the experts said to us was that people want to have what they're saying reflected back to them. And you can do that badly in the sort of, I hear you, you are saying this. Or you can do it really well, where you think about what is the underlying emotion here? What do they need to hear from me? And then you build on it. And it's a little bit of a, I'll show you mine, you show me yours kind of thing. But that's how the best listening works.
For Feinberg to do his job, I mean, he really has to weigh one side or another, if he doesn't get it right, it can be pretty awful.
Yeah. And the thing that's funny about this is it's Thanksgiving, and we're all about to sit down with our family. And even he knows family is the most challenging listening. Family disputes. I asked him, do you mediate things in your own family? And he kind of laughed it off, and he told this funny story about when he tried to do that with his kids when they were younger.
You know, I remember once when my kids were younger, very young, 5, 7, 3. I came home one day from work and they were fighting with each other and my wife. And I said to all of them, I said, well, I'm a mediator. This is what I do for a living. Why don't I mediate this dispute? We'll work it out. And there were two reactions from my children, mind your own business. And from my wife, yeah, you can go ahead and mediate it as long as you come out on my side. So I learned to keep my mediation experiences in the office and not bring them home to the household.
So it's really about deciding when to speak and when not to.
Yes.
When to, if you hear something, really evaluating in a careful way whether you react or not.
Yeah, and I think if you can retain some little nuggets about what someone said 10 minutes ago and relay it back to them like, oh, how was that surgery on your cat? How did it go when you had that issue at work? You're going to win because people will know that you heard them.
Well, happy Thanksgiving, Mary.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, John.
Mary Harris is the host of WNYC's podcast, Only Human. You can learn more about Only Human's deep dive into all things listening at onlyhuman.org/listenup. Still with us? Well, we don't want to overdo this listening thing now and turn you all into spies around your Thanksgiving table with listening devices and the like. And this isn't the PC police manual on how to survive a discussion of current events at a Thanksgiving table in 2015. These aren't new issues. It's just the old matter of being polite. All this stuff about listening and knowing when to speak really boils down to a sense of old-fashioned manners. So we asked Henry Alfred, the author of Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners, who he would go to help him around the pitfalls of a modern Thanksgiving table and what good listeners he would consult. And he said, just for us, he would ask the advice of some hostage negotiators. That's right. Hostage negotiators.
These are folks who are working at the very peak of the experience of trying to talk to a hostile or highly distracted person out of, you know, what that person is trying to sell.
I mean, that's really an awkward moment. Getting past an awkward moment, these people can do it.
Yeah. And if you can talk someone off a ledge, then you can certainly handle Aunt Barb and her reactionary political views.
When is it more polite to shut up, and when is it more righteous to speak up?
Well, I thought, to me, the most interesting technique that came out of this was apologize even if you're not at fault.
Mm.
And that is something that I've done, that you know the other person is at fault, but if you open up with, hey, I'm so sorry about this situation and I feel like I created it, even though you aren't at fault. But I was surprised that a chief negotiator for the FBI, you know, someone who's handled, you know, war zones and whatnot, that he told me that he does that all the time.
So what if you really do need to disagree with someone? I mean, what if you really do, you know, that's too much, what you just said. You know, I've been coming here to these Thanksgivings year after year, and you know what, Uncle Bob, no. That is not appropriate, what you just said.
Yeah. Well, the gentle approach is you say, I'm still thinking about these issues, and I don't feel as strongly as you do.
I'm still thinking about these issues, but I don't know if I feel as strongly about them as you do. That's a good one.
I'm still thinking about my homosexuality.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not sure how to weigh in on it. Yeah, that's gentle. If that cue is not taken, then I think you say, you know, this Thanksgiving is really not the time to have this kind of conversation, and I'd rather we talk about something else. That's a possibility. The third possibility is you probably know beforehand that he's going to be this way, so why not do a preempt? And a preempt might take the form of your saying, if you know that your uncle's going to wax very political at the dinner table, why not ascribe that fault to a third party who's not in the room? So why not greet your uncle by saying, oh, we just went to a birthday party where this guy started talking about the wall he wants to build around the country to keep out the immigrants, and it was so awkward.
That's really smart.
That's
really having your act together.
It's a little preemptive. But you know, you deal with that uncle every year, and you know he's going to do that. So why not get out in front of it?
All right, here's a stumper from one of our listeners, all right? My aunt asked my grandma if I was gay, and everyone overheard her. I'm not, but why didn't she just ask me, and should I have said something?
Well, you can turn it around and say what makes you think that? I mean, if you want to play,
that's a good one. That's a good one.
If you want to play the game, go for it. Yeah, turn it around and throw it back in her face. And I think her having to articulate her throbbing id, you know, her bag of impulses, I think that that's going to be so painful an experience for her that it's going to curb her.
You know what my favorite fact in this little listener sentence is? That the aunt asked the grandma.
Yeah, exactly.
If she's gay.
Grandma's got her finger on the
that's
pulse.
That's a whole, yeah, grandma's the one. There.
Yeah, yeah. Grandma's gaydar is impeccable.
Here's one that's more generalized for our listeners. As a vegetarian, there are always awkward conversations about what I'm not eating on Thanksgiving.
Oh, you're a vegetarian. That's interesting.
Yeah. Silence.
Yeah, right. You're going to get that. But I think you just come with a couple of conversational gambits that are going to override that.
I mean, vegetarian isn't even interesting anymore.
Yeah, I know. That's pretty tame.
If you're not vegan, forget it.
Yeah, I think transsexual is...
Yeah, transsexual
is,
vegan.
That's the now you're talking.
Yeah, that's entry level there, right? Yeah, exactly. What are you most worried about this Thanksgiving? Speaking of all the hostage negotiators that you've talked with, all the expertise that you have, all the ability that you have to get out of awkward conversations, what's your worst case scenario this Thanksgiving?
Well, you don't want to get into a Thanksgiving where you can't acknowledge the Syrian situation, but yeah, it's just towing the line. That's always the trickiest thing, is how do you be grateful and how do you be earnest and compassionate, But at the same time, yeah, how do you not let Thanksgiving get weighed down in heaviness? Because it's really, it's a time to have fun.
But it is also a time. It's also a time to reasonably honor the emotional content of what's going on in the world.
Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, I think a lovely thing is to invite a neighbor or invite the exchange student from your kid's sixth grade class. I think that the presence of an outsider is a great way to get at this question of tonality, that, you know, even the most incorrigible troublemaker is going to be quieted by the presence of an outsider. And I think by the same token, the fact that there is an outsider, that's a great opportunity to say, what's different in your country? And, you know, what are you grateful for? And how are you seeing this political or this, you know, geopolitical crisis that we're in?
So enrich your conversations around the table by inviting interesting people. Listen very carefully to what they're saying.
Yes.
Here are some techniques to let them know that you are sympathetic with what they are saying. And don't get too drunk.
Yes. The drinking. The drink. That is a huge problem for some families.
Yeah, it gets rid of the inhibitors on a lot of them, yeah. Henry Alford, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, John.
Henry Alford is the author of Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. Thank you so much for joining us for our takeaway listening tour of the Thanksgiving table. And be sure to let us know what your Thanksgiving table sounds like or looks like this year.
My name is Beth. I'm calling from Northern Manhattan. And I can't be afraid. I work in Times Square. I'm going to be working at the parade. And I hope you all come and watch the parade or watch it on TV, because New York isn't afraid and we'll all be there together.
My name is Lee Lombardi from Safety Harbor, Florida. I honestly am more fearful of domestic shooters and think twice now about going to malls, movie theaters, and even church. I know the odds are low, but the world is so insane.
Hi, my name is Mary Ann. I'm calling from Macomb, Michigan. My youngest daughter, her birthday falls on the holiday every 4 to 5 years, depending on leap year, and today's her 17th birthday, and she's had 3 Thanksgiving birthdays so far. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Love hearing your stories. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Happy Thanksgiving from all of us here at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Curious.com, committed to helping people learn something new every day with more than 20,000 lessons on travel tips, Tabata training, toy making, and more. Learn more at curious.com/PRI. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.